The perfect combination of versatile athleisure and training apparel has arrived. Thanks to the visionary minds of New Balance, Clutch Athletics, and Rich Paul, the designs reflect the heart of the athlete and the spirit of the community. With rising defensive football stars Will Anderson and Chase Young on the roster, Clutch Athletics brings the best innovative gear to all athletes, giving them style and performance on and off the field. Learn more and purchase Clutch Athletics at NewBalance.com.
Welcome to the Cover 3 Podcast with your hosts, Chip Patterson and Barton Simmons. It's your call for the best college football coverage. From National Signing Day to the National Championship and everything in between, CBS Sports presents the Cover 3 Podcast.
Live late night Saturday, it is time for our Week 1 Instant Reaction Recap. I'm Chip Patterson, that's Barton Simmons, that's Tom Fornelli. We have gathered together because week one, not quite yet in the books, but certainly we've had enough thrills from Thursday, Friday, Saturday to fill up a good reaction pod. Right now, as we are speaking, the Trojans are out there. The Graham Harrell offensive era is rolling. If anything goes bananas during the recording of this podcast, we will address it. But until then, we decide to look back at what has happened today and the rest of the weekend. Gentlemen, how are we feeling right now? As on the East Coast, we are about to work our way into September. How are we doing?
We are feeling blessed. After a miracle, Auburn cover helped me lock up my Auburn -3.5 because I'd been on a bit of a losing streak in the locks there as the day went on. So that was a nice way to finish the day.
Well, you were firing it out of the gate, though. Looked like you were going to run away with this thing in week one. And then I think the dentist lock is where you started to stumble.
The juju. He got that drill on me and I was going down.
This was a fun day because there was really only a couple of actual marquee games, but this day was so college football all over the place. There it was just so college football. There was FCS teams nearly knocking off FBS teams. There was like so many of the preseason convictions have already been called to task based on what we saw on the field. And then with the night is closed with a really good Auburn game. And here we are as USC starts to do some USC stuff and let Fresno State sneak back in here too. So this was a very satisfying day just from a observational standpoint.
I think that I might've texted to like no fewer than like 7 different friends just who of course, you know, everyone hits you up on a day like today. And I just, and a lot of my responses were just, I love this big, dumb sport so much. Like this big, stupid sport with so many different ways that things can go. So many blown leads, so many comebacks, hearts broken. It was all fantastic. We will get to some of those FCS teams and some of those blown leads in a little bit, but let's start with the Auburn win against Oregon, because it had a lot of different angles to it, because there were a lot of different times where we had a certain outcome in mind, because Oregon comes right out of the gates. And Barton, I'll start with you first, because, you know, as we are trying to prepare for this podcast, Tom, you had to write about it for CBSSports.com. We all had our different assignments. You're kind of working all your different angles. And for a good portion of this game, you had to commit to the idea that Oregon was about to win. You had to commit mentally to the ideas like, okay, so what does this mean for Oregon? What does this mean for the Pac-12? What does this mean for Auburn? All of that. But yet, did you allow yourself to keep the Auburn mojo, the weirdness that is Auburn, especially in an odd-numbered year with Gus Malzahn backed into a corner, to think, I'm not ready to bury Auburn just yet? Did you keep that alive all through the game?
Yeah, I hadn't buried them, but I was definitely like, you know, in my head, I had composed tweets that I'd never quite, you know, sent out into the open about, you know, things like, you know, Oregon looks like the most SEC team on this field. And, you know, it was such a – Oregon looked like the better team.
Yeah.
Like, they looked like they were clearly the better team in the first half. And the whole and even as I was thinking about things like to write this week, there were storylines surrounding this Oregon win and why they're more equipped to beat an SEC team than some of the previous West Coast contenders. And then the game just starts to like barely perceptive, like you could barely see how it's shifting with the naked eye, but it starts to shift. And I look up at the end of the game, and the box score is – I mean, Auburn had better stats. I mean, without digging too deep into it, but just, like, they had more total yards, first downs, and that kind of stuff. And I just, like, was I imagining things? Like, did you guys think that too? Like, that Oregon – like, just based purely on just eye test, did you think Oregon was the better team?
Do you see those set of footprints in the sand, Barton? That's when Auburn Jesus carried you.
I mean, well, you've got the inability to get punch it in the end zone in the first half, right? So you've got two field goals and one missed field goal. Like if you're looking at total yards and first downs, a lot of those yards and first downs in the first half for Auburn were the inability to get it done in the red zone, which is both a compliment to Oregon and its defense and how feisty it was. But I do think that's probably the first place that I go to for an explainer on why the final box score shows a little bit more of an even matchup.
Well, here's what it is. Both teams struggled in the red zone. Oregon had 5 red zone possessions. It got 21 points out of it. Auburn had 5 red zone possessions. They got 17 points out of it. And we mentioned, you know, there was that dropped touchdown by Brian Addison in the back of the end zone that could have put Oregon up 14-0 and probably would have changed the entire way this game went. Instead, it was a drop. They had to settle for a field goal attempt. They missed, and they came back and got another touchdown. So Oregon's first 3 possessions went touchdown, missed field goal, touchdown. And then they scored 1 touchdown in their last 11 possessions. That was it. So it felt like Oregon was the better team for a lot of the game. But the reality is, when you look back on it, it's the Auburn defense was probably the best unit. After those first few possessions, the Auburn defense kind of took control of the game and allowed Auburn to hang around. And it's just one of those instances where you see it so many times with this Auburn team. They hang around and they hang around. And then at the end of the game, something crazy happens. And that's exactly what happened tonight.
Well, I also think, yeah, I do agree. Auburn's defense was outstanding. But you can hand some of the credit or blame, I think, to Oregon's play calling, coach. Like, it just – it felt like they tightened up a lot in that second half and didn't quite play with the same sort of, abandon the energy, call the game with the same sort of mentality that they did in the first half when they were having all that success. And I do think, you know, I had been talking about it leading up to the game, sort of the lack of wide receiver playmakers that Oregon had, and their top, arguably the top 3 guys were sitting on the sideline. And, you know, at the end that did play a role too. But I also wanted, you know, you got to touch too on just sort of the emerging legend of Bo Nix.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I was texting with some people, and one guy was saying, man, I'm sort of surprised Bo Nix didn't score that last possession. He feels like he's got some clutch plays in him or something. And then, like, you know, they get a stop and then he goes down and he does score and has the big clutch moment. And it's like, he absolutely, you know, coach's son, former player's son, Auburn legacy, all this stuff, and makes the big play in the big moment. And like Herb Street said on the broadcast, like, eyes never looked big and wide. That said, like, it was not a beautiful performance by any means by Bo Nix. Like, that was not – he looked like a freshman throughout the majority, if not all, but about a couple drives of that game.
How many – go ahead, Tom.
I was just going to say, yeah, it's like there were the two red zone interceptions, one of which was just a really dumb freshman moment. The other one was a dumb freshman moment, but I also felt like it was a strange play call to have your freshman quarterback running in his very first start. But yeah, it's he came through at the end, you know, like that on that final drive when he picked up the first down in the third and short by scrambling, that throw on third and 10, and then, of course, the touchdown throw. It's like, oh, okay, Bo Nix. He's not pretty tonight, but there's a lot of reason to be optimistic about that kid going forward.
How optimistic are y'all about Auburn? Like, as you start to spin it forward, and we've got plenty of time to digest it and pick it, and because it's Auburn, we're going to have tons more games that are going to take spotlights, both in terms of our locks and our recaps and our previews. It will be, you know, one of the most talked about teams that we have here on the show. But as just right now in this moment, less than an hour after the conclusion of that game, where do you think this Auburn team's ceiling is?
Nine wins?
Yeah, I mean, I have a hard time seeing it beyond that as well. But, I mean, I'm not going to – I guess I wouldn't put their ceiling at nine. I think Bo Nix has to get a lot more comfortable. And it's just, man, that offense is – I am – even in a win, I come away very down on Gus Malzahn. Like, that offense – as JT Daniels throws an interception in the end zone.
Woo!
That offense hasn't changed. Like, do you remember when that offense was like cutting edge? And that was the new hotness, was the Gus Malzahn offense. And it's like, oh, now Gus Malzahn's calling the plays again. Oh, man, he's going to get his mojo back. But the offense has always been his. It's just someone else calling the plays of his offense, and it always looks like this. And it's just sort of this, you know, like one receiver routes, play action shots, grind run game. And like even tonight, like Bo Nix, there really isn't – yes, he is a true freshman, but you don't see the quarterbacks at Auburn like really go through progressions. It's for Nix, it's you take – look for your shot, you play action, look for your number one option, and then you go. And part of that's being a true freshman. I think part of that's not really being coached to do otherwise. And – I don't know, man. I don't leave the game any more confident that Gus Malzahn can take Auburn to heights beyond like the 9-win threshold.
I leave the game very, very shaky with my bullish take on Auburn in the preseason. I think that what you said, Barton, is spot on, and some of it might be personnel. Like it might just be that you know, like wasn't Seth Williams a pretty highly touted prospect? He's a sophomore now, right?
Yeah, I mean, he was a four-star.
Four-star, but okay. Well, that's, you know, I just don't think that they are overwhelmingly impressive at the skill positions. I think that it felt like their most successful offensive plays were when they hid a receiver or Oregon forgot to cover a receiver. And when, like, that's how you're getting your chunk plays, I understand that some of that's by the nature of the system because Gus wants to run fast. He wants to stress the defense. He wants to, you know, put them in awkward personnel groupings, show you a lot of window dressing, get your eyes in the wrong place. I understand that, like, trickeration's at the center of it. And if, you know, part of buying into the Auburn stock, I know that I am getting some of that, but it really felt like that was all they got against Oregon was, again, at the end, the score comes in this sort of frantic moment. And before that, the only touchdown seemed to come in because of the other team's mistakes. This offense, outside of running at tempo, and there was one stretch, maybe one drive, when I thought Jartavius Whitlow really got it going and the offensive line started to get a push. But it did not feel like they were out-executing or effective in a major way against this Oregon defense. Maybe we will go on to see that is the Oregon defense, but I came out of the game like much like you, Barton, where I was like, man, this Auburn offense is really lucky that its defense is going to keep it in every single game so that it can hope one of these trickeration moments works out in its favor in all of the close games against the best teams.
They've got another big upset in them. Or, I mean, this wasn't an upset, but they've got an upset. They got a big upset in them somewhere along the way. They've got a head scratching loss somewhere along the way, and they'll toss up a few of the A&M type games and, you know, win some and lose some. So it's, I think that lands it probably still in the 8-9 win range.
Mm. Okay. So the SEC in general and the SEC East in particular really took center stage. And in the same way that I feel like we were cautioning about trying not to overreact, I wonder where we toe the line between pointing out individual bad losses and questionable situations and where we can group these things together. So, like, let's start with Tennessee. Is this an individual instance? Is this one game, or are things seriously wrong with Tennessee right now?
I think that there's some plenty of, I don't know if it's like, you know, it's not like an emergency, because we see that so much in the first week where weird things happen, okay? But they also lost at home to Georgia State, a team that went, 2-10 last year, I believe?
Yes.
So you can't write it off too easily. And it's not like it was a fluky loss. Georgia State was outplaying Tennessee for 60 minutes. It started right from the beginning of the game. Tennessee fumbled on the second play of the game. Georgia State scored right afterwards. Then Tennessee came back and took a 14-7 lead. And I figured at that point, okay, game's over. Tennessee's going to run to a route. It just never happened. They couldn't, you know, they could not get Georgia State off the field whenever they needed to get them off the field. And then in the fourth quarter, it was Georgia State that looked like the SEC team hosting, you know, the Sun Belt team. They were just grinding Tennessee down in that fourth quarter, outscored them 17-10, although, you know, Tennessee had that touchdown with 2 seconds left to make it look like it was a closer game than it was. Georgia State was just the better team on Saturday. And if that, there's no way you can look at that and say that's not a concern for Tennessee.
Yeah, I mean, it's Georgia State went 2-10 last year, like you said, Tom, and it's not hyperbole to say that there is not a single player on their roster that Tennessee wants or wanted.
Maybe Dan Ellington. Maybe. I'm saying,
yeah, like now, yeah, like Dan Ellington and, you know, but out of high school, like Tennessee took every single one of their guys over the Georgia State guys. And so this is there's zero excuse for a loss like that, like just none. And I mean, it's just hard to wrap your head around. Like, how do we get this bad? How did it sink this low? They've got players. I don't understand it. And it is a coaching staff. It's like an all-star coaching staff. So something's wrong, but who do we blame here? Like, what do we even do? Like, I don't even know where to go if I'm Tennessee. It's like, who are you firing? Who are you hiring? Who are you, like, what player? You just got done having a really good recruiting class. Like, what's, it's almost like you just got to sit and wait this thing out and just sort of, you know, wait for the sun to set and rise for a long time, and then eventually just time will pass and you will have gotten a little bit better. It's a discouraging place to be, I think, right now for a Tennessee fan.
So they said all the right things was the takeaway that I got from some of the post-game press conference. There was no excuse making. Everybody was sort of stepping up, but that it has been sort of a through line through the Jeremy Pruitt system. And Barton, if you're looking for a place to go, how about this? I would point, and this is not something that a Tennessee staff member or a Tennessee player would point to, but if I am talking to a Tennessee fan and I'm trying to talk them out of lighting their boat on fire so that it sinks in the middle of the Vol Navy, like I'm trying to tell them that on September 30th, 2017, Troy went into Baton Rouge and beat LSU 24-21. And a year and a half later, LSU was in a New Year's Six bowl game getting a win. Like, there are examples of these Just sort of strange things just aren't quite working. And yeah, there was changes that were made with Matt Canada first having to change up his system and then a changeover at the offensive coordinator position between 2017 and 2018. But these games can end up being Tennessee just didn't show up. Something's not right. There is an out for this, but it is incredibly damning when put together with the entire body of work. Like, I think that if Tennessee had a one-off loss to Georgia State like this, I think that we would dismiss it easier than having it line up right next to Missouri losing to Wyoming, right next to South Carolina losing to North Carolina, like right next to just what seems to be like carnage within the SEC East and within the SEC. I guess if you extend it out, did we have any West teams lose? Arkansas messed around with Portland State.
Ole Miss lost to Memphis.
Oh,
Mississippi
man.
State struggled with the Cajuns. Arkansas beat Portland State by 7. You know, I mean, Auburn, nothing to be ashamed of with their win, but LSU and Alabama dominated Duke and Georgia Southern. Georgia beat up on Vandy pretty well. But other than that, there weren't exactly a lot of, you know, resounding performances in the conference.
I think that Tennessee, yes, like this is going to cause a lot of soul searching, but I wonder if it is standing out even more so as one piece of a bigger puzzle or a bigger narrative that was built through the results in week one.
So I almost tweeted something like, is the SEC East the worst division in college football?
And, man, your drafts. I want to see Barton Simmons drafts.
But I, part of the reason I didn't even tweet it is because I thought about it. I was like, wait a minute. Did I tweet this exact same thing last year? Like, am I crazy? Does this happen every year? I feel like it happened last year where the SEC like either loses or almost loses to all these teams, and or specifically the SEC East. And maybe over the course of like SEC play, there's an upset or two, or they play a West team close, or, you know, we convince ourselves that they're getting better because they're all playing each other. But ultimately, like, I think this is that's a terrible look for the East, what they did today. I mean, Missouri losing to Wyoming. Missouri was already counting their 9 wins. Like, they were like, they had penciled it in. 9 wins, let's hope we win the last 3. Like, Kentucky beat Toledo, but I mean, they did, that wasn't dominating.
They were down like 14-0 early.
Yeah. They were in a fight that entire time.
Terry Wilson did not look good.
Like, reassess here. Think about this and give me an honest answer. Is what's better? What's a better division, the SEC East or the ACC Coastal?
The East, because it has Georgia. That's it. And Florida.
Yeah.
They've got 2 teams that are better than any team in the Coastal. But I think that after you get past Georgia and Florida, the difference between the Coastal and the rest of the SEC East, not very big, if there even is any.
And this might be an overreaction by me, but it also might be the proper reaction that then gets watered down with a bunch of interdivision games, and we just start deciding the SEC is better again, just because sort of, you know, the season progresses, and you know, at what point do we stop sort of making excuses for these sort of gross early season showings?
Well, I tweeted earlier today, and I got yelled at a lot by a lot of SEC fans for it. I said, and this was before Missouri lost to Wyoming. But I tweeted, imagine if the Pac-12 lost to Memphis, Georgia State, and North Carolina today. Everybody would be talking about how it's eliminated from the playoff already. And they're going to talk about how it's eliminated from the playoff because Oregon lost to Auburn by 6 points at a last-minute TD. But the SEC gets to skate by, and the response from most SEC fans is, when I mentioned that, is, yeah, but it was Ole Miss, Tennessee, and South Carolina. They don't matter. So the conference is great, except for the teams that don't matter when they lose, but they count when they win.
You know what? Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I think what happens is that the SEC probably truly does have more talented players it just doesn't have healthy programs. And that's what we've got, is we've got like a Missouri, we've got a Missouri program that had the advantage of having Drew Lock, and last year I think Emmanuel Hall kind of helped that offense move a little bit, and they've had some good defensive lines, but I don't think Barry Odom has really fielded a dominant defense since he was a head coach. We've got Will Muschamp, who has had a South Carolina team that frequently has had head-scratching losses and lacked the kind of quality win that you want to see. Butch Jones and the Tennessee era is obviously comes with all of its own oral histories and baggage that I'm not all in on Jeremy Pruitt, but I'm at least willing to know that it's going to take some time for and some recruiting cycles before things really turn the corner in Knoxville. Like they're Ole Miss. There you go. There's another one right there. I think that there are more than a handful of programs in the SEC right now that have very talented rosters, but I would not say that they are healthy programs. And I think that that really, really shows up in some of these non-conference weeks. And maybe that's why, Barton, as you mentioned, when we get into interconference play and it's talent against talent, it's conference against conference, familiarity comes in, we get some good games, and we're like, oh, yeah, the SEC's good again. Maybe it doesn't have to do with talent. Maybe it is like how healthy is your program. And that's where best becomes one of those, you know, in the eye of the beholder type analysis, because, you know, yeah, you could have the best players and you could be good and you could be the best, but if it's not a healthy program, I think there's something to that, and it gets exposed in bowl games and non-conference games in some of these more one-off scenarios.
So just to so I wasn't making it up, I just looked at last couple of like week ones in the SEC, and the 2018, 2017, you know, whatever, some head scratchers, but nothing terrible. 2016 wasn't a great week one. App State really should have beaten Tennessee, I think, because I think this is the year I was thinking that. The great Perry Orth led South Carolina over Vanderbilt. There was UMass sort of playing Florida relatively close. West Virginia beat Missouri. Southern Miss beat Kentucky. So that wasn't a great first week, but I think that's a good point, Chip. And with that said, Will Muschamp deserves all the heat right now. he has had plenty of time.
Where's the signature win?
Program to help.
Yes, 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 yes.
I mean, this is Mac Brown rolls in, takes a 2-win team, and in 1 year. First game, he's beaten South Carolina, and South Carolina needed that game. And I mean that one was in some ways that game would be more deflating to me as a South Carolina fan than Tennessee's loss would be as a Tennessee fan. You're already down if you're Tennessee. South Carolina's been trying to convince themselves that they're back for 4 years now. And Mac Brown rolls in day one.
It's not all that different. Like his, I guess you could say his, I don't know, the pattern is very similar to what he did at Florida. He went 7-6 the first year, then went 11-2, then took a huge step back in year three, and then continued to like just kind of flutter in year four. South Carolina 6-7 in year one, jumped up to 9-4 in year two, dropped down to 7-6 in year three, and now he's starting off, you know, year four where they lost to North Carolina. So it's, yeah, I wouldn't be shocked at all if, based on what I saw today. And again, you try not to overreact to what you see in the first game of the season. You really try, but just from what you saw, there wasn't a ton there to really get you excited about this Gamecocks team going forward. And I won't be surprised if come the end of the season, you know, they're all of a sudden in the market for a new coach.
Well, that's the problem. Is that to me, it's less about like what the product looked like on the field, and more about, look, if you can't beat North Carolina, who are you going to beat on the schedule? And North Carolina,
Tennessee,
right. And North Carolina might be good, but South Carolina has an absolute, like their schedule is wild. So that's just that's a bad way to get things kicked off. And Jake Bentley, man, just is the same guy. the same guy he was as a freshman. Just hadn't changed.
Bit of breaking news. USC quarterback JT Daniels was just helped off the field by trainers after getting twisted up on a sack. So his night might be over.
Yeah, this is going downhill right now for USC.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there should be anything put into the fact that South Carolina just sort of was unable to find anything? I mean, I don't know. I will admit it right here on this Instant Reaction podcast. I was pretty dialed into that game. You know, the group chats were popping. There was a lot of conversation. I was like, you know what? All right, I am interested. I want to see how this goes. And South Carolina, especially on offense, Jake Bentley put, I'm going to say, 8 passes into the ground. Like, totally 100% ineffective for the last quarter and a half. From about midway through the third quarter on, I don't know if Jake Bentley did hardly anything that was all that impressive. And that the offense has Brian Edwards, who I think is a very good wide receiver, probably going to play in the NFL. I liked Rico Dowdle as a player at times, but the offensive line couldn't get anything. And as I've mentioned before, that North Carolina defense, like when you look at the depth chart just on paper, doesn't look that big. When they get on the bus, they don't look all that sizey. Like we mentioned before, former quarterback Chaz Surratt was out there busting his tail at linebacker. Like I thought the fact that there was just no life on the sideline and no, they kept doing crowd shots to South Carolina fans. And even when South Carolina was leading still, you could just see it in their faces. It was the same song that they'd been through time and time again. Like there just doesn't seem to be much hope right now. And that kind of stuff compiles on itself where like both of y'all have mentioned, it does seem very, very quickly like all of the heat is on Will Muschamp's seat right now.
Hey, Chaz Surratt and the Tar Heels defense held South Carolina to 270 yards today, baby. That's just, yeah. Whew. Not good look from South Carolina today at all. But congrats to Mack Brown for getting a pretty big win from North Carolina. What was the stat you texted me earlier tonight, Chip, about North Carolina and Power 5 non-conference wins?
You ready for this, Barton?
Yeah.
First non-conference Power 5 win in the regular season against a team not named Illinois or Rutgers since 2002.
I love the not named Illinois or Rutgers qualifier. It's my favorite part of the stat. It's like against a real Power 5 team without saying it.
Oh, man. Good stuff. All right.
Did you see Mack Brown's post-game interview?
Oh man,
yeah, he was crying. He was choked up.
Choked up.
That was kind of dope. I kind of felt the feels a little bit. And that one got a little dusty in the old viewing studio in the Simmons household.
I like he said we made so many coach and they did make so many coaching mistakes.
Yes,
it was clearly the first game back for somebody who had spent Saturdays with Jonathan Vilma in the ABC halftime studio. yeah, so many player mistakes, so many coaching mistakes, but yeah, him saying he was going to enjoy it, and then in the 67, I guess, year old man. I don't have it, his Wikipedia pulled up, but the dance video went viral. Very, very enjoyable if you want to go see it. I'm sure it's somewhere around. But in the postgame press conference after the locker room celebration, I will probably guess that he's doing the Mack Brown politician thing. But he said that locker room was just as happy as the Texas locker room in 05. And I couldn't tell whether that would be more of a statement on North Carolina and how much those players enjoyed and that win meant to them, or how that Texas team was more relieved than happy that they'd won the national championship.
I don't know, but the best thing about getting old is clearly the fact that if you just move your arm around and your leg, right, people think you're a great dancer.
Right. Yeah. My other takeaway from the dance video was, like, it looked to me like Mac sort of knew, hey, this is the thing coaches do now. They like dance in the middle of the locker room. So I'm going to do this and I'm going to move my body parts in a few different ways. But I can't wait for this to be over. And I want to get out of the middle of this circle as soon as I can. But that was that was something.
Hey, the players loved it. That's all that matters.
The hands up means everybody starts cheering so we can end this, right? Like you, like
yes. You, but enough, guys. But enough. All right, let's get out of here.
It's like the old man dance tap out. Just put your arms in the air, like I'm
done. Oh, man. All right. Coming up on the other side, we will take a look around the country. Ohio State, Michigan, LSU, Texas, concern at Nebraska, Boise State over Florida State, all that and more next.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
All right, the Ryan Day era is off and running. Justin Fields, life looked easy for Justin Fields going up against FAU. And so I give some credit to Ryan Day and the offensive staff. I thought that they put everything out there for him. You know, you go out there, you make the right reads, you deliver the ball, we're going to have a good stat line, we're going to score touchdowns, life's going to be good. The Buckeyes did not cover the spread, so that would be an L for your boy in the locks category, that we will get to that more the following week. But I would say, Tom, starting with you, how much did you get your eyes on Ohio State, and did you feel like you learned much in a game where they were clearly playing at another level and existing on another tier than FAU?
You didn't learn much. It was confirmed. It's like, okay, yeah, so Justin Fields is good. Ohio State's talented. I mean, they were up, 28-0 in like 5 minutes?
Yeah.
The game was over really quick. And then after that point, they just kind of went into, okay, let's not get hurt mode, and just kind of cruised for the final, 55 minutes of the game, which is incredible to think about. But yeah, I mean, Ohio State's really, really good. Justin Fields had the 4 touchdowns. He had 234 yards passing. He also had a rushing touchdown, a rush for 61. J.K. Dobbins got his 91 and his touchdown. Benjamin Victor kind of just said, hey, I'm the new stud receiver. Everybody learn my name. It's spelled weird, but it's not that difficult to say. And then the defense did, just showed out. I mean, FAU finished with 21 points, but 15 of those points came in the fourth quarter when your starters were long gone for the most part by then. And Lane was just in the, well, I got to give the boosters their cover mode. So there's not too much to take away from this other than, yeah, Ohio State, good, talented, better than FAU.
Yeah. Justin Fields is sort of what we thought he was, which is good. That's a good thing. He's not. I mean, he had 4 touchdown passes and a touchdown run. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Stat.
Yep.
And I think, really, 3 of the touchdown passes were just no one near the receiver.
Yeah.
No.
like one of them, he had to at least just sort of put it in the area, because there was actually like a DB like trailing the receiver. But I'm not, I am anxious to anoint Justin Fields because I was one of the folks hyping him out of high school. But it's not time to do that yet, because this is just making sure he checks the like talent box, and I think he does. And I think the offense is going to be really dangerous with him. But we can't. I'm not sure we like can put any Justin Fields. Is like the question is, Justin Fields good enough to take Ohio State to the playoffs? I'm not sure we can put that to rest after the FAU showing.
When I compare it to Michigan, though, Barton, I did you get your eyes on Michigan, Middle Tennessee? It was
gross.
Yeah. See, I come out of today. I agree with you. Like, I totally agree. He just had to sit back there with good protection and wait for the mesh route to complete to throw it to a wide open receiver down the seam. Like, everything was laid out. It was all on easy mode. He was playing Madden on rookie. I agree with you 100%. But when I take watching Ohio State and I take watching Michigan, I come out of today as we're sitting here late night Saturday night, and I'm like, I still feel pretty good about thinking that Michigan is ahead of that Ohio State is ahead of Michigan right now. And I don't know where Michigan is at offensively, and I don't feel great about the Dylan McCaffrey kind of working him in there, but he might be better than Shea Patterson. And I don't know, man. I did not love the Wolverines' performance against Middle Tennessee.
So here's a question for you guys, and this is the instant reaction pod. So overreactions or like Saturday impressions they can change. Like, you can change your answer on Monday. It's okay. I'm not holding you to this. But how would you rank, if you had to just say today, predict the ranking of the top five teams in the Big Ten? How would you rank them?
Ohio State 1, Wisconsin 2.
Oh, yeah. There we go.
Michigan 3. Penn State 4, I guess, although I barely saw any of that game, but it sure didn't look like they had much trouble at all with mighty Idaho. And then 5th, Illinois, baby.
Brandon Peters.
So you're buying the Wisconsin based on blowing out South Florida then.
Well, I just think that based on what I saw through the first weekend, I mean, Wisconsin was much more impressive than Michigan was. It's not that Michigan was awful. They didn't blow out Middle Tennessee. It was 40-21 final. But, you know, they averaged about 6 yards per play. The offense kind of hit sputters. My bigger concern was the fact that, you know, Middle Tennessee put up 300 yards and 21 points on a Michigan defense and kind of, you know, broke some big plays there for a while. But I think Michigan, more than anything, kind of shot itself in the foot. It had the two turnovers, including one. Shea Patterson, on their very first play of the game, he scrambled, got the first down, and then got tackled from behind, lost the ball. Middle Tennessee, you know, recovers it. And then Michigan muffed a punt later, which gave Middle Tennessee a short field. So it wasn't an impressive performance by any stretch, but it also at the same time wasn't really the kind of game where I'm like, oh, I've got serious concerns, as much as it was, okay, this is still a Michigan team that has work to do. But I think that once, you know, they get settled in, they're going to be just fine.
I agree with Tom that I slot Wisconsin ahead of Michigan, and I probably have as much big impression away from the fact that it was a shutout, because, you know, when Wisconsin started to slip defensively, that was when my alarm bells went off, because Jonathan Taylor's nasty, and you can always count on some level of efficiency from that Wisconsin offensive line. But when they're not able to complement that with a really good, dominant, and imposing defense, then that's when things start to get concerning. And like, look, it's South Florida. Things are going to be different when you get into conference play. And who knows, when, as we spin the Bulls forward, where they're going to be in the AAC. But I do slot Wisconsin ahead of Michigan. I think that the Michigan-Michigan State game is probably a lot more of a toss-up than I originally considered it coming into the season. I think Michigan-Penn State is a lot more of a toss-up than I considered it coming into the season. But also, to welcome in Scott Frost, Adrian Martinez, and the Cornhuskers in there, I found it interesting that Tom didn't mention them. And I agree that I felt myself coming out of the Big Ten Week 1 conversation, moving down Michigan, moving down Nebraska, moving up Penn State, and moving up Wisconsin. But again, I leave Ohio State at number one.
Well, I want to be clear. I'm putting Wisconsin ahead of them in my Week 1 power rankings. But if they were to play on a neutral field next week, I'd be picking Michigan to beat Wisconsin.
That's my point, is I'm just curious who you actually think are the best teams based on the limited info we have. I'm not saying who deserves to be ranked what. I'm saying
I still think Michigan's better than Wisconsin. Yes, I think it's Ohio State and Michigan.
Okay. See, I am. I mean, Penn State, I know it was Idaho, But Penn State is probably going to have a better defense this year than Michigan is. They've got better players.
Yeah.
Penn State's players on defense are, I mean, they're loaded on defense. And so the question I have is with their offense. Their offense is, I mean, I don't know where the delta is between like where your offense should be against MTSU versus where it should be against Idaho. Like, I don't know what the leveling factor is that allows us to compare those two. But I grant that Michigan, it was first game of a new coordinator in a totally new system. So we should allow them some growing pains, but I just think that it's Penn State's going to have the schedule. Who they play someone this week they should beat, and then they play Pitt, and then they play somebody good. They play Buffalo this week, and then they play Pitt, then they play at Maryland, then it's Purdue, then it's at Iowa, and then Michigan. That is about as that's about as good of a schedule as you can ask in terms of building up towards like the beat of the schedule. So Penn State's going to have plenty of time to get clicking. I am tempted to think Penn State is going to be that sneaky team in the Big Ten this year. And I think that could mean they're the second best team.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's impossible by any stretch, but I'm not ready to do that just yet.
I think that if you give me Michigan State minus 6.5 at Penn State on October 19th right now, I'm taking Penn State money line.
Penn State versus who?
Michigan. Oh, sorry. I said Michigan State.
I thought you said Michigan State.
Penn State.
Yeah. I think I would too.
That's fine, but for all the struggles that Michigan seemingly had tonight, it still put up 40 points.
Like I said, this is snap judgment time right now. So I'm not trying to sentence them to anything for this.
Granted,
I'm just
40 talking. Points is only 40 points is only half of 79, which is what Penn State put up. So yeah.
As somebody who was interested in Michigan going over 55, the fact that I needed a Middle Tennessee late fourth quarter bizarro touchdown to hit that, there was a lot of frustration with Michigan's offense for your boy on Saturday night.
It don't matter how you get there. It just matters that you get there.
All right, so what about Nebraska? Is there warranted concern for the fact that it took three non-offensive touchdowns for Nebraska to win by 14?
You never want to overreact too much. It could have just been, an offense playing its first game of the season and struggling, but the offense certainly didn't look, to be firing on all cylinders. Adrian Martinez did not look great. He only threw for 178 yards. He was 13 of 22. He didn't throw for a touchdown. He had the one interception. He ran 13 times, only had 6 yards, because of sacks, but it's just, it was not the kind of performance you expect, because like you said, they needed their defense to bail them out. And when you tune into Nebraska and everything you hear about them, with Scott Frost and what he did at UCF, and when he's coming to Nebraska and they're going into year two, and last year the defense was awful and the offense is what really helped them win games down the stretch. So you come into the season against South Alabama and you think, oh man, they're gonna put on a show for the home crowd today. They're gonna put up some points against the Jaguars, and they couldn't. They really could not find any kind of rhythm offensively, and it's something I think that is a concern for the coaches, or at the very least, maybe they're looking at it as a learning experience, something to coach them up on, figure things out. Make sure maybe Nebraska got caught up in its own hype, because there's been a lot of hype about it this offseason. So maybe this is one of those chances for the coaches where it's kind of a blessing in disguise, a little bit of a wake-up call for them as they go into next week ready to actually have to prepare and play football. But I don't want to freak out, but it was, when I was watching that game, it was like they did not look sharp at all. They did not look cohesive. The offensive line, I thought, was kind of, soft at times. You weren't really able to get any push. This is Nebraska averaged 2.2 yards per carry today against South Alabama. No, I'm not knocking South Alabama, but if you can't get 3 yards per carry against South Alabama, what are you going to do against Wisconsin? What are you going to do against Iowa? You know, and so it's, that's a concern to me. That offensive line's got some improving to do.
I baked in a lot of year two coach impact for team improvements, you know, and that's probably a good lesson to not assume that just because you hear good things or I think you got to prove it in order to start to trust significant improvement. I say that with Chip Kelly in mind for that Cincinnati clunker against, where Cincinnati just totally beat the hell out of UCLA, just beat them up. Scott Frost and Nebraska didn't look like it took a big step forward against South Alabama. Obviously, Jeremy Pruitt's another year two guy.
Willie Taggart,
Chad Morris, the year two guy who didn't look much better at Arkansas. Like there's probably more out there I'm not even thinking of, but a lot of year two clunkers in week one.
Mountain West had 4 victories over Power 5 teams. Is the Mountain West back?
It is the premier group of 5 conference now, yeah.
I love the Mountain West.
Mountain West is a very fun conference for sure. I don't know if they're back because they did win a couple games, but if you look elsewhere in the conference, they lost some too, and they kind of struggled a bit. San Diego State with a big, big-time 6-0 win over Weber State tonight.
All right. I mentioned this beforehand, so I hope that you've had time to consider it. 2 questions for both of you. Number one is going to be the most stunning result, followed by the most satisfying result. And the qualifier that I want to put on this is stunning and satisfying. I don't want it to be within the context of the everyone conversation. I want it within the context of your view of college football. Like with the way that you saw things, and it doesn't have to be a lock or a prediction, but just the way that you see the landscape, what was the most stunning result where you're like, man, I did not see that coming. And then the most satisfying result where you feel like you had it called. Barton first.
I'll do for the most stunning, I'll go to the Iowa State game. I mean, I was watching that one close. They needed every bit of 3 overtimes to beat Northern Iowa. And that's a bad start for my 10-win Big 12 championship game, Iowa State Cyclones. So I would say that was stunning. Now, that said, I actually I'm not really worried about it. Like, I actually think that this can be excused because that's just what kind of Iowa teams do. They just kind of get in these backyard brawls and they all are just, a bunch of farm boys that, have known each other and they just kind of big old country fed boys and somebody wins, somebody loses. It's always close.
It's like you replace corn with, whatever stereotype we want to have for the Tennessee Mississippi border. And you just sort of say like, yeah, it was Ole Miss Memphis. It was a bar fight.
But I feel like Iowa always like messes around in this game with the Northern Iowa. Like I would have to go back and look, but I feel like Northern Iowa scared teams before, and it doesn't necessarily mean that you're not very good if you don't blow out Northern Iowa. I think Iowa State is a little bit has a little Michigan State in them where they're gonna against bad teams, they've got a tendency to maybe play down to them, but they can play up to good teams as well. But that was still just – that was troubling, as they were about to lose that game. I was rooting for the Cyclones to just sort of let me live like till week 2 for my 10-2 prediction there.
What about satisfying?
Satisfying – I think that Ole Miss struggled the way they did. I think looked about like I thought they would look, I guess. Not satisfying to see them struggle, but just I feel like I had that one pegged.
Right. And that's what I'm going for here. We're not delighting in the joy. We're not delighting in someone else's struggles, but we're just patting ourselves on the back.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is going to be a long year. And that game against Memphis doesn't really change my opinion there. I mean, I think this is still going to be a really long year. And I mean, that Cal game is going to be an ugly one because Cal ain't scoring on anybody. It is encouraging that Ole Miss's defense is playing a little better. But that was about what I sort of expected Ole Miss to look like.
Tom?
I would say the most surprising thing besides Tennessee losing to Georgia State for me was just Florida State completely collapsing against Boise State on Saturday morning. Because, I mean, that was – I felt like we went through an entire year of Kendall Briles and Florida State fans reacting to their offensive coordinator in about a two-hour span. Because this was a team that jumped out to a huge quick start, had the 24-6 lead on Boise in, like, the first 20 minutes of the game, and then just pretty much stopped playing football on offense. And the defense kept giving up touchdowns. That whole kind of thing was kind of shocked to me because I had the over on Florida State's win total this year. I thought that with Briles in there, with a second year under Taggart, I thought that this was a team that was going to take a step forward in 2019, not in that whole really competing with Clemson kind of way, but at least becoming a possible third team in the ACC that you kind of have to respect. And that all went out the window really quick in the second half of that game.
What about your satisfying?
This isn't about really for me as much as it's UTEP has won the last two bottom 25 titles. And on Saturday night, UTEP beat Houston Baptist narrowly 36-34. But the Miners are 1-0, so that means they've already got a good head start on not, you know, on avoiding the three-peat. So I'm very happy for the Miners. For at least 1 week, they will remain outside the bottom 25.
All right, I'm going to say that my most stunning result, the one that I absolutely did not see coming, was Texas just heavy-handedly throwing down Louisiana Tech. I had many, many good reasons to pick Louisiana Tech against the spread, and they did not have a lot. And I am having trouble because I don't get the Longhorn Network, and I will have to find the replay of that. I'm having trouble deciphering whether that is a good sign for a Texas defense that had to replace a lot of key players, or whether it just means we've turned a corner in this particular cycle of Skip Holtz's Louisiana Tech team. So it is stunning because I'm still trying to unpack it as we record this podcast. 45-14 was not how I saw that one playing out, especially with the fact that Texas had that thing as a shutout for most of the game. My most satisfying result is Boston College over Virginia Tech. I thought the wrong team was favored right there, and I think that the way that Boston College was able to get going on offense against Virginia Tech only reinforces the idea that you should be concerned with the fact that Bud Foster is announcing his retirement after this season, not necessarily providing the kind of landscape for a let's go do it for Bud Foster kind of attitude around Blacksburg. I think that this is, you know, we had a very smooth transition from Frank Beamer to Justin Fuente in the fact that Frank Beamer's last year as head coach, they had to beat UVA to be bowl eligible and keep their bowl streak alive. But then the next year, Justin Fuente, year one in with Blacksburg, with the Hokies in Blacksburg, takes him to the ACC championship game. Yay. Hooray, all is well. Athletic Director Whip Babcock, you did it perfectly. It's so hard to replace a legend. I think what we are finding is that the difficulties that so many schools and programs have seen trying to replace a head coach who's been there for decades might actually be happening not with the head coach, but with the defensive coordinator, and that is going to lead to all kinds of identity issues for Virginia Tech. So, I'm not satisfied that Virginia Tech is going through those issues, but it was a hunch that I had. And for Boston College, to be the underdog in that game at home against Virginia Tech and then be able to win that game pretty handily and see some of the reaction coming from Virginia Tech fans afterwards, I feel like I had that one pegged a little bit right. So, again, I do not delight in their struggles, but I at least do think that Boston College with A.J. Dillon fully healthy, Anthony Brown still there getting rolling. Like, yes, they lost some NFL players on the defensive side, but that is still a team to be reckoned with. And for Virginia Tech, whoa, very interesting season ahead for Justin Fuente.
Dude's got a dude with the dude's got a dude.
Wow.
I've had some healthy skepticism on Virginia Tech too, and I've sort of been like, what am I missing? Like, why are they being picked to finish second in the Coastal, or, you know, why are they? And I'm with you. I'm kind of like, okay, this makes me feel like maybe I wasn't crazy all along. Maybe there is a ways to go here for Virginia Tech.
Anything else in the notebook that we want to get out of here before we wrap this up for tonight?
Quickly. It was only against Eastern Washington, but the signs of life from Jacob Eason, I think, were very encouraging and could make Washington a more fun team than they've been in a few years.
Because he can move it down the ball.
That Jake Browning can't make.
Yes. Because he can push the ball 30 yards down the field.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he made some nice throws.
Yeah.
I'll send a shout out to Northwestern and Stanford for being exactly what you thought Northwestern and Stanford would be.
Oh my God, that was as Northwestern Stanford as anyone could have imagined.
Complete with knocking QBs out of the game on both sides. And also, I think Alabama's still good.
Yeah, and that defense is gonna be all right, I think.
I will give a shout out to Barton Simmons because the most Utah team that Utah could ever Utah looks about right.
I will say on the Utah deal, while that is encouraging that they handled business against BYU, did Tyler Huntley just look a little skittish to y'all? He was I don't know. They can win the Pac-12, I think, because it's so Utah. But they, I don't know, for them to be like a playoff team, like, that's hard for me to envision Tyler Huntley in the playoffs. He just wasn't, I don't know. I seem to remember him being better than he looked the other night, but that's Utah for you, you know?
I mean,
he called
BYU BY Poo in the post game press conference, which is just so pleasant and nice. What?
He called them BY Poo?
Yeah.
Well, he just earned a Heisman vote. not because I don't like BYU, but because that's some good, solid 5-year-old punning right there.
who got eliminated from the Tom Fornelli team of excellence this week?
A lot of teams have so far, but I mean, I'm not finished yet. There's going to be more teams. I'm going to have to go through it and as I reevaluate and work on my rankings and all that stuff. But so far, officially, Georgia Tech is out, because they were serious about giving up the option. UCLA for failing to cover against Cincinnati and ruining our lock unity and my first Twitter tip of the day of the year. Western Kentucky, because you can't lose to an FCS team and expect to win the team of the year. Purdue scheduled a road game against a G5 team and got what it deserved, just like Missouri, who will soon be adding this list. And then Tennessee lost to Georgia State at home, so they're gone.
So one pet peeve of mine right now this time of year, and I don't know whether this info was out there and I just didn't do enough due diligence, but like, how about UCLA come to find out Joshua Kelly isn't even playing, Darnay Holmes didn't even play, there were a couple other like very significant contributors that just
would have been
playing.
Useful info.
I know. Now, I'm not saying those guys, they may not have made a difference, because Cincinnati just they were just I mean, that was across the board ass beaten. But I think it would have been – it might have scared me off a little bit knowing Joshua Kelly and a couple of those other guys weren't playing.
Mm. And one final statistic as we wrap this up. This is via Sam Kahn of ESPN. Y'all ready for this?
Yep.
Auburn's game-winning touchdown pass against Oregon was Auburn's first go-ahead touchdown in the final minute of regulation since the kick six versus Alabama in 2013.
Oh, it's going to be a good year, Chip.
Auburn's going to win the football game.
He is Barton Simmons. You can follow him at Barton Simmons. You can follow him at Tom Fornelli. You can follow me at Chip_Patterson. Please subscribe to the Cover 3 podcast if you haven't already. It's the way that you get it delivered right to your device when it's live. We'll be back on Monday with more putting together the pieces. We'll see if USC was able to survive, because right now they are only up 7, so things are getting dicey. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Later.